welcome to this week's episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast with myself, Jasmine Harrison, and I'm joined by Joe Kirk and a smiling Phil Brining.
Hello. Good afternoon.
This week's session is a GDPR radio in which we talk about news and views and all things data protection. And there was too much to talk about this week when was not enough, but it was a good session regardless.
I thought,
it went so fast.
I know. I thought, well, we haven't really spoken about anything. It's 50 minutes had gone by.
I know.
Unbelievable.
But yeah, we started talking about data quality software and consulting. We just partnered with an organization and they provide a fresh concept to data, you know, wider than personal data. So we explored that quite a bit, which I enjoyed quite a lot, to be honest. It took me back to Rebecca Balibaco's session.
Yeah, and then we moved into talking about processes from there, because obviously they would be a processor. Yeah. And we had a good chat about processes and processor contracts. You led that, Joe, so processor contracts. I think it was quite an interesting discussion.
Yeah, I think the whole session, I thoroughly enjoyed myself. It was probably one of my favourite ones. As you said, we didn't talk about too many different topics, but really went quite deep, didn't we? And you're right, Phil, we touched on the requirement of what needs to be in place between a processor and a subprocessor, and whether you should have one agreement if you rely on a subprocessor for multiple different controller relationships, or whether one overarching policy agreement would suffice. So yeah, listen out for that conversation.
We talked about picked up some anomalies, didn't we, as well? Anomalies, apparent anomalies on the ISO's website and in the GDPR. And it was just, again, I thought it was quite, for me, I thought it's quite, hopefully, thought-provoking as a session, you know.
Yeah.
We didn't
actually manage to talk about the differences between the German GDPR and the UK GDPR, which you mentioned that you wanted to do, Phil.
Yeah, we'll have to pick that up next week. It's just the interpretation there's a case in talk about next week, and it's about automated processing and decision-making. Automated decision-making, sorry, Article 22, and the differences in translation between the GDPR into German and to English. And
it's funny you say that, because this morning I was looking on LinkedIn, and John Baines, I think he used to work for the ICO, on LinkedIn was posting about how he was reading the GDPR text in English, German, French, and maybe I don't even know, different versions anyway, and I was just thinking, why? But clearly there are differences between them, and it's worth unpicking that.
I think the discussion that started, Joe, about data protection by design and by default was good as well. Again, thought-provoking, you know, what's what and how do you do it, and caught Jasmine on the hop a little bit, but you recovered quickly, Jazz.
Yeah,
could probably expand further, can't we, on that next week when we're talking about the role of a DPO.
I felt bad because it reminds me of when sometimes when I'll be asked, you know, by a customer a question and I'm put on the spot, I'll be thinking out loud, so I'm in my head, I'll weigh up both sides to something, so I'm going down one route and they're like, okay, yeah, taking notes, and it's like, but then you have to consider this and flip it on its head. But then, no, going back to that, and it's just so chaotic. I was thinking, I don't want to do that so much on here, but you didn't really leave me a choice, Joe.
Yeah, or say good point, I'll have to do some research and come back to you on that one.
Yeah,
and that was good. And your classification policy, Joey, I think you threw some good curve balls in today.
That was Jasmine.
That was Jasmine, yeah. Classification policy, another good one.
I didn't know what classification meant, apparently.
Oh, that's right. I remember now, yeah.
I just didn't realise that's what it was called, but yes.
I have the memory of a goldfish.
But yeah, anyway, we'll let you get involved or get into these conversations in a bit further detail, and we hope you enjoy it when we will be back next week for a session on the role of the DPO. So stay tuned for that one. If you've got any problems with that, let us know after the session. So how has your week been, Phil?
Deja vu. My week's been
been
all right, I suppose. I've been focused on trying to get this audit report written up from the audit I did on last Monday, and I've struggled with it. I've got it done, actually. Now I need to read it through, but I got it done eventually, but I kept getting interrupted with stuff and finding other things far, I have to say, a bit more interesting than recounting and writing on my audit report. So that's a bit of a bad thing. But got that done, which is good. And I've got quite a lot of other interesting things I've been on with this week, you know, helping the consultants with, you know, a few things like a breach, which we're going to talk about today, hopefully. Lee sent around a really interesting just thoughts about the granularity of privacy information. So I felt compelled to drop the audit write-up and do some digging about and spend an hour writing a response to that. And so it's been a bitty week, to be honest. How about you?
Yeah, too? Sounds like a good one. What about you, Joe?
Yeah, my week's been free of Roper calls for a change, which has been really nice. It's given me quite a lot of time to catch up because I had 2 weeks off in the middle of July. So I've been able to really knuckle down and get some progress done with some of my customers, which was really nice, actually. Wrote a couple of thorough advice and an interesting case, actually, I came through from one of my customers that I do want to talk on here as well later on. And also I've been liaising with Tracy to set up some consultant workshops because we've had 2 new consultants join us. And obviously me and myself, you know, I've been around data protection people for a long time now, and I'm getting to grips with it, but I've moved in consultancy not that long ago as well. So we're going to have some sessions weekly starting towards the end of the year, end of the month, because everyone's diaries are booked out in the next week or two. But yeah, so I've just been kind of liaising with Tracy, asking for the other consultants kind of on topics they'd want to cover, and then just getting those in place as well, really. Yourself, Jasmine?
Good.
How's your week? Busy selling?
Yeah, mine's been good. It's good. Busy selling.
No annual leave this. No annual leave this week for you.
Well, no, I'm having a week off. So I'd work for a change.
A week off being off. Yeah.
No, it's been good. I'm finally getting back into the swing of things, which, to be honest, after all my annual leave, it's weirdly all right. Although I'm not sure how long that will last. But yeah, it's been good. We had a meeting across the team earlier this week, and we spoke to a partner of ours, something that I want to talk about today. So they their services include data quality consultancy, and, you know, provision of software to improve on your data quality and identify or create data strategies and things like that. And I just thought it was an interesting angle, because obviously we are quite involved in, you know, the law, data protection law specifically, obviously, and that goes a bit wider than that, but is also probably a little bit more practical as well in applying the law. There is overlap between data protection legislation and then just overall governance of your data, and I just thought it was quite interesting, so I wanted to explore that a little bit. I don't know if you've had much dealings or many dealings with this kind of thing, but they provide software on arranging and identifying any gaps, arranging your data, identifying gaps, misinformation, inaccuracies.
So it's not quality software of the data as such, it's quality of a data set. You know, it's identifying potential patterns and outlying values and gaps, is it, and that sort of thing.
Yeah. They do it with structured and unstructured data, but, you know, off the back of our conversation last week around information management software and DataWise, I thought it was relevant to bring it up, especially it integrates with those softwares as well, those systems. So it's more relevant, you know, now than ever, and as we progress in this digital age, as ChatGPT loves to say.
No, it's interesting, because when I worked at Everton many years ago, like, I don't know, like 10-12 years ago, I suppose, we had, partly how I got involved with Everton was that the database was just a complete disaster zone. They bought this Siebel CRM system, which cost them like £1 million or something. It was like cutting edge. Siebel was like cutting edge, you know, very, very expensive enterprise grade system. And I was asked to go and have a look at the data quality, and I looked at it, and there was like multiple entries for the same person, like office of the club and things. So it was a real mess. So then they moved from Siebel to Salesforce. And we set up data quality measures every week. A report came out of how many new records have been created and how many gaps were in the database of critical fields that we identified as being key. And we used that as a real strategy to try and drive the quality of the fan data across all the different touch points, you know, the retail, the community, the ticketing, everything. So I've kind of got some experience of that, but we never use a third party. There's probably were systems around. We never use a third party system for it. We just like did our own data quality reports. Paul Nash, yeah. The data manager, he was really good at it. You know, hot on it. And the chief exec at the time, Robert Elstone, you know, became one of the key pillars of strategic pillars of the business was quality of data. It was quite interesting.
Yeah, no, it's something that I want to explore a little bit further, to be honest, because I've not really had direct exposure or experience to that side of things, you know, in terms of on internal systems and so on. So it's an interesting concept, but I just think, you know, as time goes on, it's going to become more important, and especially if organizations start integrating AI into the software as well. You know, you want to ensure that you've got accurate data that it can, draw or create output based on. Otherwise, it's pointless, really. It's a waste of money, yeah. Isn't it, and time?
I think accuracy is kind of how right data is, isn't it, in my book. So, you know, you need a kind of a benchmark to compare it to. You know, my address is accurate if it reflects the reality of where I live. But that's different from there being a gap on the database because I've not put my postcode in, or I've put my county as North Yorkshire, which, you know, technically yeah. It is, but postal town is Middlesbrough. So it could be that, you know, accuracy's got different meanings and interpretations. My rule of thumb in the GDPR stuff is, you know, I kind of say, well, you know, this is right or wrong, and it stands to be shouted out and corrected, but, you know, some data is more important to be accurate than other data, and in some contexts the same data is far more important to be kept up to date as well. So I think a lot depends on concept, on context, and kind of purpose and sensitivity. So this data is sensitive to accuracy, keep it accurate. This data is less sensitive to accuracy, you know, it's less important to keep it accurate. I don't know what everyone thinks of that approach.
I think, I suppose then, let me rephrase it in terms of, you know, how organized and structured your data is. And, you know, if you've got multiple records of something that is inconsistent with each other, then that's going to create difficulties moving forward. But by being able to identify those, you can address them and make sure that you've only got information and data that, you know, is relevant, is appropriate. And then from there, you can move forward.
Yeah, it's interesting. So I think I just want to say things like, you know, if you've got like a medical condition, information about a medical condition, it's less important for it to be accurate when it's that sort of being processed for the purpose of a lifestyle survey than it is if it's being processed for the prescription of medicines. So it has to be absolutely, absolutely up to date for the latter, and it don't really matter to the former. But it's the same type of information, but a different purpose, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, on this as well. So the organization that we've partnered with, they can help with data classification as well. So I'm not sure if anyone listening has heard of the phrase of a data classification scheme. I think that's right. But I'm questioning myself.
It is right.
Now.
It's spot on. Yeah. It's spot on, Jasmine.
I was thinking, is it scheme? It sounds off. I want to get your thoughts on data classification schemes in general, whether you think they should be applied in every situation, if so why, if not why not, you know, if things changed since 5-10 years ago in terms of the importance of a data classification scheme, etc.
What do you think, Joe? You've been very quiet up to press.
Well, I've been quiet because I'm sat here thinking, what on earth is a data classification scheme? I don't
Oh, of course you do. Don't play that card with us. Interestingly, the audit I did last Monday, they had an information classification policy.
I thought you turned in the conversation.
No.
Carry on.
And they said that, you know, all data will be classified, all documentation will be classified. And none of the documentation sent me through was classified at all. And had no protective marking on, none of this internal, confidential, public or whatever. That's what it is, Joe, when you can't even say, well, this information here, it's for internal use only. This information can't be made public. This information is strictly private and confidential, and therefore can only be used by this limited small team for these limited small processes, for instance. I think, right, I'm going to stick my neck out here. I think that they're more trouble than they're worth. I think keeping it up to date and applying it is just so difficult. Therefore, you know, if you can make it stick and work, great. But if you can't, you know, all you're ever going to do when you're looking at it is get frustrated that it's not working properly.
And be in breach of your policy that you say, you know, that you've put in place as well.
Yeah.
That's what I've always thought. But then on further thought, I think, you know, as time moves on and we move more, everything is, you know, turning completely digital, really, if it's not already. It's probably more important than ever.
Well, I think,
and I think,
yeah, we probably
having, you know,
naturally
proper governance over your data, is really important.
Yeah, we potentially already have kind of some notion of classification policy by actually defining data as personal data, you know, cardholder data, and any other classification that we apply to it. It might not be marked up onto the data and the metadata, but, you know, we've already got that kind of notion, I think, inherent. And we're applying different rules and scenarios to those different, just those two different types of data. You know, they get different rules applied to them. So I think whether we define it and document it or not, and how far we take it, we're probably already, everybody, applying those kind of information classification scheme principles to what it is we're doing.
Yeah, so
that,
it already kind of
that
happened.
That might be
so
a bold assumption.
Employee data different from customer data, you know, personal data different from non-personal data, sensitive personal data or special category personal data different again. But that's what, yeah, I don't know.
I mean, these things are all documented in Europa as well, aren't they? Sorry, is there a delay?
Personal data. No, I was just thinking about what you said.
So was I.
Personal data is obviously documented in Europa, but this goes past personal data. This is all data, so probably more an information asset register than anything. Well, both obviously, but yeah, I don't know. I think obviously some organisations, even when it comes to personal data, they might not, you know, they don't have anything more than a statement to say that they are GDPR compliant, you know, and maybe a privacy notice on the website. So I think there might, it depends probably on where an organization stands and the necessity to introduce one, you know, to just organize and manage and maintain this oversight of the data, I suppose.
Yeah. I mean, some standards, you need to have information classification schemes, like either 27001, you have to have something internally. But how far you take that, you know, I think depends on what you're doing it for. Same as the whole concept of an information asset register, you know, why have you got an information asset register? What is its purpose? You know, I know that Europa required by law to have one, but information asset register, is it for compliance purposes with a particular standard? Is it because you think it helps you find data for dealing with a SAR? You know, is it because it helps support the data classification scheme, which in then, you know, has other inherent benefits, whatever they might be to the business? Difficult to say, really, but interesting point. So what do they help with? What can they do to, you know, other than data quality? Do they have information classification schemes that can apply?
So they provide consultancy as well, where you know, they can advise you on how to create an information classification scheme, how to create a data strategy, and then obviously the software that can go alongside that to identify anomalies. That's a hard word to say. I think I just need to speak slower. And you know, gaps and inaccuracies and so on. They can help pull information, you know, for SARs and FOIs as well. It's quite broad, to be honest. I think, you know, in the same way that our support desk can advise on all things data protection, they can help with all things data quality and organization. But yeah, it's an interesting fresh perspective, to be fair. It reminds me of, you know, when we had that podcast session on with Rebecca Ballybacco. I love saying her name.
You're very good at that one, aren't you? You can't say anomaly little use, but you can say Rebecca Ballybacco.
I've said it so much, it's just fun. It rolls off the tongue. But yeah, about privacy engineers, it's just a different concept to the same things that we discuss week in, week out. So yeah,
I enjoy it. Was a great discussion with Rebecca, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, it really was. But yeah, moving on. So have you seen anything in the news? Is there anything you want to discuss in particular?
Well, I think we've been quite a bit in the news, but Joe's going to go first. Joe, after
you. Are you sure? Thank you. well, sometimes it can happen, can't it, on here, when there's three. Two can just get so intertwined, I'll just put my hand up and let me... I'll go. So there is something I want to talk about. Suzanne, one of our new consultants, came to me earlier this week with a question from one of her clients, and it's around sub-processors and sub-processor agreements. So the customer mainly acts as a processor, and obviously relies on other, would you call them then, or their processors? So they're a sub-processor to the relationship with the controller.
That's what people
is that
do, yeah. People kind of call them fourth and fifth parties, don't they?
Yeah, sure. So let's say they rely on fourth parties to assist in delivering, what's expected of them with the controller. And they was pondering what they need to have in place from a contractual standpoint. So obviously, Article 28.4 says of the UK GDPR says that where a processor engages with another processor for carrying out specific processing activities on behalf of the controller, the same data protection obligations as set out in the contract or other legal act between the controller and the processor, as referred to in paragraph 3, shall be imposed on that other processor by way of a contract. So essentially, the processor should have in place with the sub-processor what the controller and the processor has in place, so a data processing agreement.
Yeah.
Is everyone following? I do talk quite quick. I guess the question is, if you then rely on a sub-processor to assist with 10 different controllers, different relationships, do you need to have a specific sub-process agreement for each relationship, or can you just have one overarching one that just contains all the information within that one agreement? Now, that's a question for everyone listening as well.
Yeah, I reckon. Good question.
It might depend on, how broad the services that they provide are. If it's quite similar and generic, then
sure,
you could probably add it to one agreement or include it within one agreement, but you might be at risk of missing some information out. And it depends how complicated it gets, I reckon, because, there's probably pros and cons to both. But having one, it's easier to oversee. But then what if
the terms between one controller and another? That's the key thing, isn't it? So if one controller wants breach reporting notification like within 12 hours, another one, and everybody else on 72 hours, what do you do with your sub-processes? You have to reflect the contract with your controller.
And that was what I said to Suzanne. So I said to Suzanne, so what it says there is that it says that it has to be, I know it says similar, it doesn't say the exact same, but in my opinion, it would make sense for the processor to sell the sub-processor, the subject matter and duration of the processing, the nature of the purpose of the processing, and the types of personal data and the categories of data subjects, at least within that agreement. So that will probably vary from contract to contract. So I think having one full contract that has 10 different things in just is incredibly difficult to manage. I think there's a lot going on. And if the duration of the process is different, that means you have to go back into that agreement and take that section out. So I just think that's a lot of work to do, as opposed to just having different sub-processor agreements in place, as you would with different controllers. If you're, a controller to a processor, you'd have separate data processing agreements in place, wouldn't you, as opposed to one overarching, because it's different.
Yeah,
so I don't see why it would be any different.
If it was me, I think if it was me, I'd try and have one, to be honest. If I had if I was providing in fact, we are providing a service, right? We're providing data-wise software as a service, so therefore we're a processor in that respect. And Salesforce, which is the platform it sits on, is a sub-processor. On Salesforce's sub-processors, there are fourth and fifth parties. And I would expect to have one processor agreement with Salesforce rather than one for each of our clients.
Okay. To be fair, Suzanne went to Tracy and Tracy said the exact same thing. And I think that's just the beauty of data protection, isn't it? That, people, it's open to interpretation, isn't it? And it's never really as straightforward as you might think.
No, but it's a cracking question. This is, down to the wording. I think it was really, really, really interesting thing about the wording of the GDPR. And the differences between the German translation and the English translation, which we've got time for, want to talk about today. But you said at the outset that the Article 28.4 says that the controller has to have the same data protection obligations. That's out in the contract. Yeah. So if you have got contract variation between your clients, then you ought to be reflecting those with the processor. So that in itself, makes it potentially quite complicated.
I think it's quite complicated whichever path you go down, whether you have one specific contract for, say, 10 different processing activities, or if you had 10 different agreements. As Michael says, what happens regarding retention as they might vary. I think regardless, if you've got a template, all you've got to do is stick it into each separate template as opposed to just listed on one agreement. I just think it could be quite difficult that then when those relationships with the controller, like, you know, cease, then you have to go back in and alter it. I think that's quite a lot of work as opposed to just, you know, I don't know. Or maybe would you leave it on there and just keep it as a record to, as like accountability to say that this relationship has happened, it's just now seized, and you just leave a mark next to that on that one agreement.
I don't know. I think if, you know, processors try and get standardized contract terms with their clients, don't they, the controllers, so that there is no variation, they don't have to accommodate all these various variations. And presumably they would do the same with their sub-processors. And if your sub-processor is a big tech corporation, they ain't going to be flexible enough to say, well, tell you what, we'll just modify this condition and term for you, that say don't use a platform. So yeah. I think pragmatically,
that's easier said than done, though. Getting a for a processor to have the same contract or data processing agreement with all of its controllers, I think there's usually a bit of pushback with that.
It depends on what the service. If it's a SaaS platform, and I think it's probably quite easy to achieve that. But if it's not a SaaS platform and it's, you know, actually some kind of other data processing activity that's being done, you know, potentially by humans, like mail shots or data cleansing, which might vary, you know, the process might vary from company to company, control to controller, then yeah, I guess you probably have process variations. But I think it's a good question, Joe, and you know, good to raise it. Gets you thinking.
It does. I was a little bit stumped. It's not something I've come across either before, really. I don't, from a personal experience, anyway, I'm not really ever engaged with sub-processors as such. It's not really that I don't really ever see that level.
Now, I was doing the kind of processor section on this audit. I keep bleating on about that. I did a week last Monday. I chose a selection of the processors that the client was using and did some, you know, digging about, due diligence on them. And I found quite interesting things. I found one of the, they said that their CCTV system was a Chinese system. And occasionally, it just barks out these Chinese statements randomly from the actual speaker on the camera. I thought, wow, that's spooky. Why are you a bit worried about that? Well, no, it seems all right. Anyway, he said it was provided by this company called Nui. So I dug around on Nui and I found actually they're Californian. And I read through all the documentation around Nui, and there's nothing in there about a process agreement, no privacy information, nothing. So kind of flagged that as that's one scenario. You know, there's nothing in place. Then I looked at another scenario, which was Slack, which is part of the Salesforce estate. And I found loads of documentation around Slack and, you know, process addendums and this and next thing. But you've got to actually go on to this Slack trust platform and sign a copy of it. So it's a standard data post agreement with standard international transfer clauses. And you go on and you sign it. So that's a really interesting approach because, you know, if you don't sign it, it's up to you, isn't it? You know, it's your liability, but it's there as a standard form. And you can sign it and download it. And then, you know, it's pre-signed by them and all their partners, Trello and all these other tech stack companies. So that was another extreme. And then I found one in the middle where it was another company whose name escapes me. But they said, if you want a data post agreement, email us and we'll set one up for you. And of course, my client hadn't done that. You know, they just kind of like just signed up for this service and not bothered to kind of follow through the due diligence process. But I was quite interested in looking at that, the various options that there are out there. You know, nothing at all. Ask us and we'll provide something with it on a self-service approach. And there's probably scenarios where it's actually, you know, in place correctly, but I didn't find any on this occasion.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I don't really see the point in having, you know, an email and we'll send one over to you.
Well, I think it's a global scenario. So they're providing services around the world, and they said if you're in Switzerland, the EU, or the UK, then email us and we'll send you out data post agreement. So why they wouldn't do what?
Why not
Slack
just
have done?
Post it though?
Well, yeah, exactly. I don't know, but
yeah, because that's more risk then. And you know, if that is over, if that's missed, then you're not in an agreement with them. So it exposes both parties really.
Well, you're right, it does. But I was just interested in the variations. I mean, all this process stuff is highly relevant because of the ICO fining a processor this week, £6 million, you know, for having insufficient security in place. So it's very, very topical.
Yeah. Agree, yeah.
What are your thoughts on that?
Is that the first time that's happened, that a processor?
Well, No, well, I looked into that because I was interested to find out myself. And I remember that in Europe, there were some processes that were fined a while ago. And I went on to the Reachwatch website and I queried it. And I found quite a few, but I didn't have time in the end to look at it because they're not in English, the judgments, unfortunately. But there are quite a number of Article 28 breaches, and some of them are processes in Spain and Iceland and France and Italy and Croatia and Germany and Poland and Cyprus and Portugal and Ireland and Slovakia and Romania. So there are quite a few, and I don't think that there are loads of them.
Yeah,
but I'm pretty sure there have been some processes on the continent fined
for
lack of contract and security provisions.
I'd love to know why they took that approach, because obviously we know that controller is ultimately liable, aren't they, for any infringement that the processor does. But is it a case of, say you're a controller and you carry out your due diligence and this organization has all this information on their website that says they've got these measures in place, and you know, you kind of have to take that at face value to an extent, don't you? So then if you do that and you engage with them, but then their security lets them down, as it did in this instance, there's only so much you can do, I guess, as a data controller. If, you know, if this organization says they have these stringent measures in place, but then those measures fail, it's quite, I do find it quite difficult to see how they could even pin that onto the controller, as they've not done in this instance.
Yeah, even if the, even if, you know, you haven't asked the specific question to find out specifically how, you know, they've got things set up, you know, the controller, the processor is still guaranteeing to have appropriate technical organization measures in place. But in this case, yeah, there was data exfiltration, wasn't there, of 890 people's information who were receiving care at home.
Oh, sorry. 82,000 people in general were affected by this. Just as a little bit of context for anyone that's not heard about it, it's Advanced Computer Software Group that were fined, and they provide software to the NHS and social care services. So, you know, it's quite a colossal breach, really. It was a ransomware attack that affected nearly 83,000 people, and included some sensitive information, special category, it didn't specify.
It was due to just one person not having multi-factor authentication on their account, I think, wasn't it?
That's right.
That's all it is.
Yeah.
It's crazy, isn't it, how it's all it takes. You know, just one
scary,
small
really.
Vulnerability.
Yeah. But back to your point on the due diligence, Joe, you know, the question, do you have multi-factor? I mean, this is what asking the audits, you know, do you have multi-factor authentication? Oh, yeah, we have multi-factor authentication. Okay, so you're using 25 different systems. Have you got multi-factor authentication for every user on every system? That's the question that it should be asking, really. But you know what I mean? So in this case, you know, the due diligence questionnaire comes back, says, yeah, we got MFA on this specific system, but this person wasn't applied for them. You know, so your due diligence, whether you've done it or not, would have still come back positive, relatively low risk, you know.
And that was my point as to why it's then not been put onto the data controller, because if they say, yes, we've got it, and it's on every system, it's on every person, and then they forget to do it, or they do an update, for example, and they update for whatever reason, means that one authenticator has been missed off of one person, and then that's led to the vulnerability. You can't then go and blame the controller for that, can you? I don't think so.
I suppose
anyway.
In this instance, with the information at stake, I mean, we always talk about what level of due diligence do you do, but it's sensitive information in this case. You know, does this not warrant an audit of the processor? I suppose, like you say, you know, you probably still, it could still slip under the cracks, but you still need to take those extra precautions because of the information at stake and the risk at stake as well.
Yeah, I think Advance is a big company, isn't it? They're a big organization. They own quite a lot of different sort of sub brands, like Iris. They own the accounting software.
Right. No, I wasn't aware of that. I mean, I've come across them though, definitely when doing ropers for some of our customers. So yeah, I didn't know they owned Iris though.
Yeah, they do. I only know that because there was a system called Software for Sport that did sports ticketing, and they were bought by Iris, and Iris was bought by Advanced.
Right, okay.
So, my ePay window that we use.
No one else was affected, were they?
No.
I was wondering, as part of this fine, you know, whether obviously the ICO have taken an approach not to fine public services, whether this is seen, you know, as an example, really, just to raise awareness within the public service sector, obviously the health sector in this instance, to be careful, whether, you know, they're I don't know what the phrase is, but the scapegoat almost.
Well, I would hope this is a shot across the bows of processes in general, saying, you know, you're not off scot-free. You can't pin it all back on the control. You have got face up to your responsibilities, and you know, if you don't, and there's a problem and it's your issue, fault, then we're going to come after you. I would have hoped that was some driver behind it as well.
Phil, you
Talking
sent
of
something over to me
processes.
earlier.
Did I?
We've all got so much to talk about, haven't we?
I wanted to check this out, right? So I'm going to share my screen here, right? So I was looking at the responsibilities of a processor when I was looking at the sub-processor thing with Suzanne. And the ICO's website here, what does it mean if you're a processor? And I think that I just want to run this, right? This is notification of personal data protection infringements. You must notify the controller immediately if any of their instructions would lead to a breach of the UK GDPR or local data protection laws. Now, I think this is something that's frequently misunderstood within the GDPR. And so I wanted to kind of throw it out there because I don't think that's what the GDPR actually says. And I'm going to try and juggle my screens here. And again,
And
I
your
don't know if
tabs.
anybody's. Yeah, my tabs. If anybody's interested at all,
Not too bad for you, Phil.
I'm going to use a, come on, machine, the GDPR. As you can see, I've got the keyling schedule open here as well. But I'm going to use GDPR. I'll go down to Article 28 here. So this piece here, with regard to point H, the first paragraph, the processor shall immediately inform the controller if, in its opinion, an instruction infringes this regulation. Blah 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 blah. And it's the same way it's transcribed in the UK GDPR. But this says with regard to point H, and point H is about making information necessary to demonstrate compliance with the obligations laid down in the article, like audits and everything. So I think that obligation to tell the controller about a potential infringement only applies when they say, show us you comply. And you say, oh, well, we can show you this much information, but if we show you that information about our employees, it's going to infringe the GDPR. I think
Right.
that's how it should be applied, not a general overall, you know, you've got to tell us if we ask you to do something that's going to infringe GDPR. But every time I read a process agreement, it's usually got that phrase that the ICO has got on their website, and I think it's wrong. I don't know what everybody else thinks.
Yeah, no,
Anyway.
I do agree that it reads like that. But so it only applies, so you should only inform the controller when there's just specific areas of their processing that infringes the
No,
GDPR, not all of it.
only when they ask you about demonstrating compliance. You know, like, we're
Right.
going to come and inspect you and audit you here. We're going to inspect you. You can't look at those records because they're nothing to do with you. You're looking at those records would contravene the GDPR. There's no lawful basis to show you them. Therefore, we're
Right.
not going to. That's my
So
read of it anyway.
I agree. So then my question to you is, do you think that that should be changed in line with the ICO's guidance? Because I
No,
think
because
the
I don't
ICO's
think.
guidance is probably a good thing, no?
No, I don't think it is. That means you're expecting a process to know more about a controller's business than the controller.
Yeah, I guess so. I was thinking more in the sense of like if you know that.
You'd be challenging everything. Well, what's the lawful basis for that? You know, show me the records of consent, because without that, you know, I might be in a position where you might be asking me to do something that's contravening the GDPR. I don't think that's the spirit of the GDPR at all. Processes controlling what a controller does. But what do I know? Anyway, you were going to say something, Jasmine. I'm going to stop sharing my screen and
Oh, I
leave it
don't.
hanging.
Oh, yeah. We'll move on. It's that one's gone over my head a little bit in terms of what it actually means. I'm just trying to get my head around it. So when, you know, reading that as it should be, when should they inform the controller in
Well,
with
when it
regards to audits?
Yeah, with regard to the obligation to demonstrate compliance with the obligations laid down in Article 28. So let's say controller says, I want to come and do an audit of your, you know, premises. Right, I want to have a look at visitor logs. You might say, well, no, you can't look at our visitor logs, you know, because, you know, they're not, it's not relevant. There's no lawful grounds for processing. You might say, well, it's a legitimate interest, you know, but I'm just trying to think of, I can't think of a really good example where they say, right, we want to have a look at these records. And you say, actually, you can't, you know, we want to have a look at your employee absence records. no, why? You know, there's no lawful basis for that. You know, if we share those with you, then we'll be infringing the GDPR. I think that's what it's about, rather than we want you to send this mail shit out on our behalf, or well, that might infringe the GDPR.
So it gives some power back to the processor to have control over its own data, or data that it has involvement with, I suppose.
I think so, yeah. Or it could be IT, you know, security. We want to do some inspection of your IT security measures. You know, well, you know, we'll show you some information, but we won't show you it all, because if we show you it all, that might infringe the GDPR. But I'm just highlighting it, because we like the academic side of it here, don't we? So it's just something to consider. Anyway, you were going before I rudely interrupted you.
I'm used to it. I'm only joking. Joe.
Wow.
Joe, you saw something in the GDPR this week, didn't you? Might be a good segue.
I did, yeah. And I'd be interested, Phil, if you've spotted it before. Did you know that Article 13 of the UK GDPR does not explicitly require a controller to state the types of categories of personal data?
The types of categories?
Yeah, as in like name, contact details, categories of terms.
I think Article 14 does, doesn't it? Because the assumption is you're not collecting it from the... I think the assumption is... that they're providing it to you, so they know what they're providing, I think.
But then why is it always included in customer-facing privacy policies?
For the same reason, why is security always included? That's not a requirement.
Well, I don't think it should be. I take it out, but I'm just saying, I think it's useful, and I think it's a good idea, probably, because it's transparent. It's about transparency, isn't it, right? I think it's useful to do so, but I don't know. I think I was just always under the impression that it was on there because I always see it in privacy policies. Whereas security, I know that it's not in there, and I always recommend taking it out.
This has got a feel-good factor. Let's put in some security, but you know, blah, and hopefully, you know, people will feel more warm and woolly. But when people shoot, I laugh when people shoot themselves in the foot. Like they say, we're using TLS, SSL, secure socket layer in communication with you. Oh, God, that standard was deprecated a decade ago because everyone knew it was insecure. You know, change it. Yeah, change. Anyway.
It's like seeing the data protection at 1998 as well.
Yeah, I tell you what, another thing, right, as we're talking about oddities, right? I read a case this week, which was, and it's already escaped my mind, I only read it about half an hour ago. Yeah, the High Court has awarded £3,000 in compensation for a personal data breach called Ali v. Chief Constable of Bedford Police. And without kind of going into the whole details, basically, the Bedford Police were given some information in confidence. The person who gave it asked to remain anonymous. And one of their employees, and then they shared it with Luton Council and didn't anonymise the data. They didn't uphold that request for anonymity. And an employee of Luton Borough Council got hold of that data. And anyway, the person who shared the information with the police, you know, had a hard time over what they'd shared. And the High Court ruled that the police were in breach of Article 51A of the GDPR. And I thought, but the police aren't subject to the GDPR. They're explicitly excluded from the GDPR, aren't they, in Article 2B? The posting of personal data by competent authority for any law enforcement purposes, see Part 3 of the 2018 Act. The regulation does not apply to them. It says so in the GDPR, UK GDPR. So why is the High Court, I mean, I might be missing something really obviously, but why is the High Court citing a breach of the GDPR by the police? And my reading is that unless there's something about what they're actually doing and that aspect of it was caught by the GDPR, but in the main, yeah, I think the police are excluded from the GDPR. They've got their own law, the Law Enforcement Directive, the Data Protection Act.
Might be an appeal coming.
I agree. I think you've just knocked your mic. You sound a little bit, it's like you're in a fishbowl.
So I'm getting excited, getting worked up.
I do agree. You'd think that there'd be an appeal, as Jasmine says. So we'll have to keep an eye on that, Phil, see if anything comes of it.
Yeah. Right, I'm going to calm down now.
I actually have another area of data protection that I would like to discuss on here. So as I've moved into consultancy, I am now the DPO for some of our clients.
Moved back into consultancy.
Moved back into consultancy. I am now the DPO for some of our customers, as we obviously provide an outsourced DPO service. And part of that, I have to undertake monitoring for some of our clients. And I picked up off the back of some of Vicky's work, and she agreed to do monitoring of accountability and privacy by design and by default for the last month. Now, accountability is something that I felt quite comfortable with, but I would love to hear the listeners and you too, your thoughts on what you'd be monitoring in regards to when you're looking at data protection by design and by default at an organisation. Not to put you on the spot. But
wow, that's put me on the spot. Well, I'm going to let Jasmine go first because she's been itching to get in.
give me a minute.
Data protection by design and by default.
I mean, this might be stupid. I'm just thinking out loud. So, you know, go easy on me. But I suppose one starting point would be looking, brain thinking out loud. So at looking at your systems and what, you know, automatic settings you've got in place, whether they are privacy focused, you know, whether you have access controls and privacy information, etc., and rights that settings that allow you to amend those as you see fit, but also with the default setting as being privacy focused. I think I'm probably thinking in terms of customer facing software. That's where my head's going initially, because that's where I usually deal with data protection by design and default. But it ties in with accountability, because you should be considering everything you do from as an organization from a data protection a pro data protection standpoint, I suppose, and then making sure that those things are embedded. So there's probably different angles to look at it. So I've spoke about, you know, the software side. The human side would probably be training before handling personal data. There are a couple of ideas, Phil.
Thank you.
It's a bit messy there.
I don't know if you've seen the document that the Spanish regulator produced, the AEPD. It's got 7 principles of data protection by design and by default. And so I think that's quite an interesting starting point to have a look at when you're thinking of data protection by design and by default. And I think it is quite an odd area to look at. So in the audit I've just done, you know, I'm looking at that as a concept, and then I'm looking inside of what I've found as evidence in the audit. I'm thinking, well, what is the evidence? I split it into two, that there's data protection by design, you know, built into processes, built into systems. And the things you said, Jasmine, like, you know, access controls, they transfer data on the spreadsheets up to Department for Work and Pensions and then get some benefits information back. You know, do they have to send everything up there? You know, what if it gets compromised? What if it goes to the wrong place? You know, so how is there any evidence that in design meetings and all that type of stuff that data protection comes up, or is it an afterthought? And then the default bit is, you know, in reality, you know, what are the settings? You know, are, you know, things get set up and configured for the default setting to be, you know, protecting people's personal data? So I think you're absolutely right. The right kind of things. But those AED 7 principles, they're a bit, you have to think about them, because they're a bit fluffy, like proactive, not reactive, privacy as a default setting, privacy embedded into design, full functionality, positive sum. These are what they say, end-to-end security. You have to then take those principles and really think them through and see how they apply. Visibility and transparency, and then respect for user privacy are the 7 principles. But it's quite an interesting read, and it's in English, which is good.
Emma said in the chat, so review of technical measures and governance protocols with ICT systems, tapping into procurement for new processes and systems, DPIA process during project work, and then organisational measures through to the end of life of systems and deletion of data. All good points.
Yeah. All good points. But it's a good question, because it's one of those things.
It does, yeah. When we say in data protection by default as well, obviously we kind of go to the like default setting, and we know in that we're talking like, you think your first thing you go to is like systems and stuff, but we also think like data protection by default in like the metaphorical sense, in that it's the default like way that you approach the way that you process personal data, like from a human perspective as well, rather than all system based. So, you know, by data protection by default, yeah. So like and you're saying, okay, so we've got this process in, we're filling the Roper, it's there's quite a lot going on here, it seems like it could be high risk, I'll do a questionnaire to see if a DPIA is required by law. Is that kind of like what we mean also by default, that it's like the first thing you think of is data protection?
As opposed to
all systems and stuff.
Yeah, I think that's where you bring it into process as well. Like Emma says, you know, building it into the procurement process, for example, regardless of whether it's an IT system or not, you know, if you have it, so the next stage is to consider whether a DPIA is needed or due diligence, for example, etc. Then you're building it into that default approach and process.
Yeah, it is a strange concept to try and get your head around and apply. So well worth highlighting, Joe.
Yeah.
Lovely. Thank you very much, guys.
I can't believe it.
Are you off
20
now?
Past. We've not spoken about anything. We're at 20 past already.
I've had so much coming my way in terms of like interesting topics. I've got another one if you want to go again.
Depends I'll how take that. It is, Joe.
Well, I don't know if either of you two want some, if you have anything to touch on.
Well, I'll tell you, I just kind of, sorry, Jasmine.
It's all right, go ahead.
No. Well, I noticed something, again, it's quite interesting, because the Brazilian National Data Protection Authority has issued out a directive on the duties of a data protection officer. So I'm going to put a link in to that in a second, because again, I think it's, again, worth looking at that, because sometimes we kind of like, what do we mean by monitoring? You know, particularly if we're in like contracted in, what does a client expect us to do as a contracted in data protection officer? And there are some things documented, aren't there? And there's some working party papers about the role of a DPO. But I'm just interested what the Brazilians, you know, have said in their directive. And they're kind of saying, well, you know, one of the duties is recording and reporting security incidents, keeping records of personal data processing operations, compiling data protection impact assessments. So sometimes what we say is, oh no, we're not responsible for compiling them or doing them, we're responsible for reviewing them. But again, this is just why I'm quite interested in the, you know, just thinking about what they've said, you know, implementing internal oversight and risk mitigation mechanisms, implementing technical administrative security measures. Wow, that's quite a responsibility, isn't it? Establishing internal processes and policies, drafting contractual instruments, handling international transfers, implementing good practices and governance rules, designing products and services that are compatible with the principles set forth in their law, like privacy by design, and other activities and strategic decisions related to personal data processing. Again, quite interesting to, you know, to look at the different approaches that different, you know, regulators are saying about that.
No, that's interesting. That conflicts of interest piece I did on the role of the DPO, I did a bit of research around it on, you know, the ICO's website, the working parties guidance, etc. And the head of IT was identified as one conflict of interest, whereas it seems like a dual role there at the same time. So it is interesting that on that point as well, our session next week is on the role of the DPO, so we can discuss that further then.
Yeah.
Is it? I thought it was on international transfers.
No.
Okay. That's me putting my place. What do I know, eh?
That'll be the next one.
I just rock up at 12:30 every Friday, not having a clue what we're going to talk about. I'm
yeah,
joking.
No.
Oi! I'll have less of that.
One thing that I wanted to bring up today was around the resignation of the Biometrics and Surveillance Camera Commissioner. I'm not sure if you've seen that.
Did see that, yeah.
I have to say, I didn't.
Yeah, so he is, it's Tony Eastoff. I don't know how you pronounce his last name. But he's stepping down mid-August, you know, as I think he was in a temporary role to assist with the delivery of the Data Protection and Digital Information Bill, which obviously isn't progressing anymore. But I just thought that it was interesting timing, as Keir Starmer has announced that he's going to roll out, you know, even more budget towards facial recognition technology. So I don't know if there will be, you know, I don't know if ulterior motives is the right way to put it. It sounds quite sinister, but you know, if that will affect who will take the role next.
I did see it, but just to comment what you said, I think, you know, to in regards to the data protection bill, I think it was brought in to help deliver the closure of the office on commencement of the data protection and digital information bill, as opposed to actually bringing it in place. So I think he was there just to make sure that it doesn't come back.
Oh, all right, okay.
I think so, anyway. That was a statement I got from the government website.
Fair enough.
Very interesting point, though, about kind of facial recognition. I think there's an argument for both sides, isn't it, for whether it's good or whether it's quite invasive. Didn't you mention to me earlier that it was your granddad that said that they've got technology now that they're able to scan a face even if they've got it covered up?
Yeah, I can't remember who I had this conversation with. I think it was my granddad, but it could be anyone. But whoever it was said that they'd seen, I don't know if it was on the news, that facial recognition technology can, obviously with everything that's been going on in the past like week or so or 2 weeks, you know, there's a lot of people getting around with the face covered. I'm not going to say any more on it, but facial recognition technology is able to identify people even with, you know, face covering, scarves across the face, etc. And I remember hearing about this in China. So I think it was around, don't quote me on this, but I think it was, you know, obviously with everything going on in COVID, their lockdowns, I think they went on for much longer than they did in the UK. And people were being arrested for, you know, leaving the home when they weren't supposed to and whatnot. And I heard at that time that they have facial recognition technology to identify people who are, I suppose, misbehaving in inverted commas. And even if they've got, you know, the face covered with a mask on, etc., they can still be identified. So it took me down that route, really. Sounds quite similar to that, and probably the way that the technology is going. I don't know how, but I suppose it's just through being able to identify the top half of your face, you know, your eyes and, I don't know, shape of your head or something.
Yeah, there might be very distinct characteristics that allow the recognition to pick up, but I don't know.
It seems strange you can read through a balaclava or something.
If that is the case, though, you know, there are concerns. There's already concerns around data accuracy and you know, in identifying people. So I can't see that adding to helping the cause, really.
No, agreed. Now, I saw a news piece that really, really grinding my gears. Four UK, or I think it's five actually, Phil, because you told me about one. Five UK news outlets have implemented the pay to reject functionality on its websites. Now, this is relating to the placement of cookies on their devices. So you either consent to the placement of cookies or you pay a fee to not get the cookies placed. And I can't wrap my head around it, because it's not lawful. So, like, what are the DPOs doing? Are the organizations just ignoring the DPO's advice, or are the DPOs just not aware that asking for payment is not freely given consent and that therefore it's an infringement of the law? I can't wrap my head around it. Or maybe are the organizations saying, okay, yeah, look, we understand that this is an infringement, but we get money from sending data to organizations in order to place targeted ads, and that money outweighs the potential monetary penalty notice that we might face should we be caught. I just don't get it. And I'm not necessarily looking for an answer. I just kind of wanted to vent a little bit, to be honest.
Yeah, there was. I noticed a few, like, I think The Independent and a few others are doing it as well. I'm sharing my screen here just because there's a question about how to get you kind of your news. This Lexology is a subscription. It's a free subscription, and it comes out every day. And it's, you can decide what you want to be notified about. And, you know, there's often a loads of not relevant stuff in there. But, you know, without fail, every week there's like four or five news stories you think, ah, right, I must read that. I click through and you go to an article, and they're good, you know. So I use that as a really good news source. Freevacy is great, but it comes out too late for the podcast, and it comes out on Friday. Again, that's just a collection of links, but you just click on something and it takes you through. And the fact it's a free thing is good. And I use Mondac as well, which I have a weekly newsletter for Mondac. The PDP news source is really good as well, if you can kind of get on that. Most of them are free subscriptions.
Yeah, PDP is good, but I found that they are quite late sometimes. So
couple of weeks behind.
I'll use Freebasy quite a lot. Yeah, especially for the podcast. Because even though the newsletter comes out on a Friday, they still have the news stories, you know, they add them throughout the week. So I feel like they do save a juicy one for the Friday newsletter, because there's many times where we'll only see it after. But with PDP, it'll, you know, you'll see things the following week or 2 weeks after, like you said, Joe. But regardless, you know, it's still all good, relevant stuff.
They do have a
weekly podcast.
They do have the odd thing in there, though, don't they? That is kind of new and not really picked up elsewhere. And I also feel like the Freebasy stuff always tends to be written by The Guardian as well. So I guess if you maybe check out The Guardian, I think they're quite on it with data protection news. But I think if you just type in data protection news and you go like the BBC, it's often dead crap, isn't it? It's not very good at all. So yeah, I echo. We all use the same stuff, don't we? So yeah, Freebasy, Lexology and stuff, PDP, all good tools. But I must say, you can't go out now and create your own podcast and start talking about news. I know you're joking.
Please join us.
So before
we wrap up, I don't know if there's enough time to talk about it, but Phil, I wanted to just pick up on that email that you sent to me this morning after your conversation with Lee around privacy information.
Oh right, yes, yeah.
Yeah. Do you mind?
No, of course. Well, I don't know. Yeah, I'll tell you afterwards. Ask away.
Oh no, it was just to explain the conversation. Really, I had a quick glance over it, and there were a couple of points that I thought were being discussed. It was literally a glance, like 2 minutes before the podcast. So I thought you'd be able to explain further, and if it is relevant to what I was thinking, we can have a conversation around that.
Okay, fire away.
I'll put it to you. So from my perspective, I'm gonna have to remind myself now. Could you explain it, Phil?
Well, Lee asked questions about the granularity of information about recipients on privacy information. I think that was the essence of his question.
Yeah.
And I remembered the TikTok monetary penalty notice, where the ICO was very critical of TikTok for not explaining which recipients individually were, you know, likely to receive personal data. And also on the Osterreich Post case, the European Court of Justice were very critical of Osterreich Post. So that to me shifted the goalpost from categories of recipients. And basically everything I'm reading about that is suggesting that it's not a choice that the controller's got. It's kind of like, you know, you need to be giving recipients information about recipients, and where that's not possible, categories of recipients. And apparently this is, and I haven't kind of poured over, I wrapped that together just to help the team. But apparently if you read the relevant recitals, you know, it kind of becomes a bit more clear of the intention of the GDPR, and therefore, you know, it not being a choice, one or the other, you know, taking the least line of resistance, but just tell them categories like suppliers or processors. We actually have to tell them which ones. Unless that's not possible.
Yeah, on that, I mean, in a lot of cases, you know, there might be quite a lot of recipients, and I feel like that would then affect how transparent, in essence, that your privacy information is, because you don't want to, you know, fall
bamboozle everybody.
To
no,
information
right.
overload. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You're quite right. It's the same with a lot of this, isn't it? The context is
same
key.
With retention as well.
Yeah. 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 Context is key. You know, in certain circumstances, you know, it becomes counterproductive to name all your recipients like it does with the flipping cookie opt-outs, you know. But that's what the interpretation is. The current interpretation is that you've got to go further than just naming categories of recipients, unless it's impossible or counterproductive. And then you might have to introduce some sort of layered approach that becomes more easy to consume that information.
Yeah, I've always thought a layered approach. Don't get me wrong, there are some that should be reference, but then it's how do you differentiate between those that should be explicitly stated and those that don't need to be. It can be tricky to it can be a subjective opinion, really, can't it?
Yeah, I'm gonna stick my ear. I know it's really, really long, so shall I put it in here? I'll put it in here. This is my this was my kind of musings on the subject, with some links in there. So apologies for clogging up the chat with that absolute rubbish. But if
you're having a conversation with yourself,
exactly. Yeah, if everyone's having a read of it, then there it is. The weekend reading, Sunday morning over a cup of coffee or something stronger.
Anyway, we'll wrap it up there as it is past the hour. But thank you everyone for joining. We are back next week for a session on the role of the DPO, Joseph. but yeah, so stay tuned for
And next week, of course, is our employee annual barbecue. So we'll be wrapping up quick as we can next week to scoot off to Midgley Towers. Yeah, for the Barbie.
Looking forward to it. Yeah, it will be a good one. But yeah, so hopefully we'll be in high spirits then anyway. But yeah, we'll see you next weekend. In the meantime, have a great weekend.
Cheers, guys. See you later.
Thank you. Bye.